Who from? Is this a landscape?
How do you think?
I don't know, that's why I asked.
What that mean? I just wondering what. So, landscape. So in Chinese, we literally we translate into feng jin.
What does that mean?
Which means that I think it's a very modern term. So, literally, it means the scenery with wind. So it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't speak out what exactly it means in your context.
So, when I say landscape, well, I suppose I mean different things. Sometimes when we talk about a landscape, we mean in terms of, you know, art or architecture, like a landscape painting. It also brings up for me things like environment or ecosystem when we're thinking about biology. But of course, that word isn't capacious enough, right? Because landscape suggests perhaps something that surrounds something, but isn't part of it. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I'm just thinking how this word, you know, refers to the relation between subject and object. It seems is more about a way to observe.
Right. And in English, when you say landscape, the idea of observation is already built into it because the scape means, you know, something that can be seen or observed. It's a visual cue.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking there is a very traditional term in Chinese context, which is very much related to the meaning of landscape, but probably is totally has a different approach. So this term is called shan shui. Literally, it's the combination of mountain and water. So shan means mountain, and shui means water.
I see.
So, but you never actually separated. So this is actually the term which is also very philosophically very important to look at the way of how you can also think that this term also refers to nature. So again, but the meaning of nature also can be very much about this exchange of eternal and external. So it's the term which has quite a dynamic meaning, because the combination of mountain and water brings a very different elements into a one body. And mountain is relatively more static, and water
relatively.
Water is a fluidity.
Right.
So therefore, it's something that you can, you know, how they could somehow, you know, together to generate a kind of meaning of circulation, of exchange. So this is somehow, I was thinking, you know, when this landscape, how this addressed in different contexts, and then I think there is a different way that we could, you know, look at the world and also build the relation between the human and the so-called the world.
Right, and I want to get to that in a minute, but I mean, notice how many times you said look at or see or watch, right? So if we're trying to think our way out of landscape as a visual way of understanding an individual in an environment, then one question I have with regard to mountain and water is this suggesting a kind of dynamic space in a way that you think landscape does not.
Mm-hmm.
Because, right, you said the mountain is relatively static, the water is not, the water is acting on the mountain and vice versa. So is it about more of the relationship between the two than mm-hmm. just saying land? And then also, is there an observer, or I shouldn't say an observer, is there an entity that is presupposed by this word that roughly translates to landscape, but not exactly, right? Because landscape mm-hmm. suggests someone's looking at it.
Yeah.
But perhaps this conjunction of mountain and water doesn't assume that.
Mm. I think basically there is I think the question of, you know, when you try to, you know, inhabit it yourself into where. And I think this mountain and water essentially has a metaphorical meaning, that how human inhabited your body into the universe. So, but it's never, you know, fixed as a kind of certain meaning of that it becomes landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So actually is the suggestion that you constantly need to explore and search this space by taking this as a kind of entry into it. So therefore, if you look at the Chinese art history, eventually the landscape painting, the so-called sansui painting,
it
becomes quite important, not the genre, but it's quite important the subject, where that in thousands of years that many of artists, basically they are scholars or officials, because there is no professional artist for a long time, you know, in the history. So therefore intellectuals that eventually that they all working on this subject. And so, but in our time, if we look at this painting, it looks like quite similar. You know, if we are not very much, you know, like prepared mentally, study, and then you just look at this painting quite similar, because they are all like, you know, they have configuration with the mountain and also with the water. But then, but if you really go into the historical kind of study, mm-hmm. actually is very complicated with this configuration. So
how so?
I don't know whether you can compare with like probably like a Renaissance painting, because you always see this constantly interpretation of the subject of Bible. You know, the story. But then I think there is a different approach to the humanity, and then which is construct a very different awareness of how the culture transformation built up our perception on the world. So, but just, you know, very, I don't think that it's even like proper comparison, but what I want to say is actually the so-called sensory painting is constantly changing. So therefore there is very interesting recent conversation between me and the artist Zhou Tao, mm-hmm. a Chinese artist, that he has been working on the film for a long time, but then there is this film, there is this moment that actually we were talking about the revisiting of literal painting. And for me, it's very interesting. So he has this film project called Fan Dong. So it's translated into the worldly cave. So, and the scenario actually captured from different locations, like from Guangzhou in China, from Arizona desert in the States, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. and island in Spain. And also somehow it it's kind of a survey of a different human situation, like construction. But then, so it's a little bit like ambiguous with all this, the shifting of the location. But I think there is a kind of certain perspective that you can feel from the time when, you know, the movie image opened up in the duration, where that you can even think about, you know, the kind of wrong score of Chinese ink painting, where this perspective is very much focused as a kind of a one narration, actually is more according to the kind of changing of the topographer than its generate its flows of landscape. So
can you give me an example?
Like for example, yeah, it's a, I think it's a challenge, you know, to talk about the movie image as well as talking about the painting. I think so there is one example is for example, there is a scenario of people are fishing in a kind of quite a muddy land, and then with a kind of a flashing of light and with a sound, so then slowly that you kind of you know, figure out actually this is a kind of land underneath the high speed way. So it's kind of leftover land, but people actually find themselves to go for the fishing. So there is mouth, like, and then so it's then it goes into another scenario, which is kind of it looks like a mountain, with a very kind of intense like texture, the mountain, and then there is sun or there is a moon arise, so it looks like a very beautiful, very typical landscape. Painting, but actually it's the leftover of human construction, you know, because the huge of the project, and then the all this concrete, you know, leftover, eventually becomes mountain. So this is actually the moment that when you suddenly realize that this, you know, leftover. Things of human construction actually generate kind of its let's say the landscape, but actually I think the approach to the, you know, the this part of the world actually kind of reflect like different, I guess different awareness that in order to see it and also to include it into a kind of dimension of time and space, because this is kind of a hidden reality but emerged through the movie image. So,
two questions that I want to ask before I forget them.
Yeah.
One is, so in the example of the construction site that looks like a kind of a typical landscape of a mountain and a moon, one thing I was thinking about is the way that you write about the relationship between landscape and architecture as things that obviously change over time, but also things that shift depending on their use or their reuse, their intention and their abandonment. And I found quite interesting this description of leftover material.
Yeah.
So I'm curious in what ways these entities are, for example, the construction site or the mountain, have to do with what you refer to as non-intention, and if that's something that we can use to understand both architecture and landscape as things that either assume some kind of guest, right, temporary inhabitant, and then what happens when either the living thing or the social forms that that landscape is designed for, that building is designed for, leave or new ones come in. That was the first thing I wanted to ask. The second is about the relationship between landscape and things that are built by human hands, and whether it's even useful to make a distinction between the two, given what you just said about how this leftover, you know, detritus can have the same aesthetic function as a mountain.
I think probably I will respond to your question gradually, that think further about what Zhou Tao's approach to the surrounding, that how he somehow kind of realized that the connection with the Chinese literature painting. And this is actually very much, I think, later we will approach to this this kind of leftover landscape, because we never ever could get like this kind of harmony or this kind of so-called the perfection of the environment, of the utopian sense of the you know, this relation actually is very much questioned in the sensory philosophy, because it's never as kind of fixed kind of expectation of how we try to, you know, to be in the nature. So it's a very different idea from today's like this kind of go to resort, enjoy nature, and have relaxing. So I just pick up the conversation, part of conversation from Zhou Tao. Actually, he said that I haven't thought much more about how the language of Chinese painting could, you know, be transformed to different media such as film, but then there is what initially drew my attention to the infrastructural mountain had to do with the conflicts and ruptures related to the historical context of literary painting. So the water and mountain are not accessible landscape on paper that people normally think of. So by rediscovering the relationship between the body and the nature, they project a sense of kind of disruption, because Chinese culture went through traumatic change in the Yuan Dynasty, which is which was in the nearly 13th century. And so the empire was somehow dominated by Mongolia, the nomadic, the barbarian. Yeah. So and then there is a huge of kind of maybe decline of let's say the Chinese civilization. But meantime, is a very important historical turning of the literary painting, because the. So Zhou Tao actually was saying that the Chinese intellectual were excluded from the political mainstream, and then they retreated to observe the meaning of their surrounding environments and started to produce a kind of painting that does not rely on color and technique. So it's the kind of a modern perception on the Chinese ink painting, like black, white, you know, very strong brushwork, not probably, you know, like I think it mainly is inherited from the time of Yuan Dynasty, where the intellectual, the Chinese intellectual kind of marginalized. And so therefore, but war in build with the spirit and the feelings straight from the heart. So, and so if you compare with like different historical period, and then there is always a kind of a merge of different configuration, because actually this so-called painting process actually never as a kind of individual, you know, kind of isolated expression. Is very sensitive on the changing, not only the social environment, but also the, let's say, the universe, where that, you know, the human, how, you know, you're through the individual body that you can sense the changing of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And another example is in the earlier time, like in the Song Dynasty, which is also a quite very kind of paradox, kind of paradoxically very conflictual time, because it's again there is a kind of kind of nomadic. Somehow take the power, and then the empire actually lost the most part of northern China. So mm-hmm. they moved the capital to the south. And then there is this artist called Ma Yuan, that his painting somehow is very much, so again, it's the sensory painting, it's the landscape painting, but actually he has a very limited angle. It's almost like you see through the landscape through a very specific angle. And so his painting, normally we call it like you see the landscape through a corner.
Is it that it's obscured, or is it just a very shallow landscape?
I think it's more about the configuration actually emphasizes on the awareness that you see things through a very limited limited perspective.
Mm.
While the earlier one from the Northern Song Dynasty, which is around the 10th century, so they are much more confident, they're much more, let's say, you know, we call it a grand landscape, mean that actually there is that you really sense this kind of confidence of cosmological approach to the universe, because basically that you built up, that you have sensed that, that you have this, that you have more like a connection with with the land. So therefore, again, I think this kind of leftover landscape, I think it's taking place in different social transformation, where that you have this sense that actually you are in the time that that you are not able, like, to grasp the more like a tangible relation, you know, with the surrounding. So
right.
Basically, that you, yeah. So
and what you just said
yeah.
makes a lot of sense to me, because
yeah.
one of the kind of ironies of that is a landscape painting is supposed to be a representation of a landscape, more or less, right? But what you just demonstrated is that you can't actually think about a landscape painting without also thinking about all of the historical contingencies and ways of thinking about nature that are folded into the ways in which people have chosen to interpret that image.
Mm.
So it seems like very much any representation of nature is being shot through by the social or the historical.
Mm. But I think from beginning actually is try to that's I think why it called the shanshui is also, you know, it's somehow it's try to not represent the nature, So basically, it's the construction of the universe where that you can not only project, but rather, you know, to a you know, open up this entry into this exchange of energy. Therefore, I think the process actually is very different from that you try to represent in a kind of certain scenario that to you know, and then to introduce the maybe kind of certain I don't know, like the I think the approach actually is more emphasizes on kind of certain effect of the bodily experiences, where then it opens up this this, you know, entry into something more transcendentally about the how human, you know, position yourself.
So can I try another? I guess it's an analogy that came up in an earlier conversation, which is we were talking about the work of the biosemiotician von Uexküll, and right, his theory of the tick, and right here in Germany, the notion of Umwelt, I mean, you see it on the bag from Kaiser, so it's not that theoretically dense, perhaps, but it, in the theory of the Umwelt that von Uexküll described, and then this gets picked up by Deleuze later on, the entirety of see, I don't want to use the word landscape, but I also want to use the word environment, right? That this condition, right, the external condition of the tick is made up of whatever sensory capacities the animal has, right? And when it's paused or latent, then there's no kind of input, and then the Umwelt doesn't exist. But when it's functioning, the Umwelt consists only of the things that it's able to sense, the things that the environment impacts on the organism, right? So it's not about a kind of physicalist understanding of how something is placed in a larger context, but about how whatever is surrounding any given organism is actually produced by that sensory relation between, in this case, an insect and the external stimuli that are being generated. So it's, I mean, for one thing, it's less visual, but it's also more it's something that's mutually generated between the living thing and wherever it's emplaced.
Yeah. I was thinking actually. Maybe I just take an example. So a you know, there is this ancient philosopher, actually, Confucius. Actually, he would say that, you know, like the wise people, you know, the people with wisdom, they love water, and then the Ren people, they love mountain. But Ren actually has a very complicated, like, meaning, because it could mean like mercy, generosity. Benevolence and or virtuous. So therefore, this actually, you know, this more like kind of, I think it's more about this the concern of the how the space that human inhabited can be a process that you can cultivate yourself. So therefore, the painting technique is also not only particularly about, you know, kind of generate like a beautiful painting, is rather is very much associated, like the brushwork is very much associated with this process that how you preserve the energy, where that you deliver the energy through the painting, and then to create this process of sharing, and then open up the space.
So right. This, and cultivate is a really important word, because you already mentioned gardens earlier. Gardens are obviously cultivated spaces. It's nature, but it's been formed by human hands. It's also a place where people go to be cultivated, to be certain kinds of people, by choosing to enter into a certain kind of environment that will have an impact on them. And right, of course, there's also culture as cultivation, right? Same idea of a cutting. I'm wondering if this is part of what you're suggesting with regard to the ways in which certain aspects of mountain or water, how they come together, are productive of certain kinds of people as well.
I think the Chinese garden is very much somehow connected to this century thinking. The interesting thing is also it's kind of located in the reality.
What do you mean?
So located in the reality because it turned into a physical construction. So the space basically that it's that you can transform this philosophical concern into a real space where, again, that you can have a daily kind of encounter and daily experiences that accumulate more like a kind of shifting, you know, from social life and also from the socio-political limitation. So some of the Chinese garden actually is based on the literal painting, which for me is less of interesting because it becomes a kind of aesthetic kind of imitation of kind of artwork. But I think there is some really interesting example of the Chinese garden is very much based on a kind of life philosopher, because it tried to not to materialize as a kind of aesthetic kind of form, rather that it's according to the topographer, it's according to the human, the individuals, you know, who live with the space, and then it generates the spirit of the space. And this kind of garden, I think it becomes kind of real practices, and also it blurs this boundary between so-called architecture and the landscape. So basically that you are not trying to distinct this, like you have a house for living and then you have a so-called landscape, you know, to be around. And because the whole space actually becomes very, almost kind of, cultivation of perception and also the gathering and the sharing for people. So, I think this kind of space mean to be public share, but actually they never to be a public institution.
What do you mean?
So it's always like individual in the basically
to the experience is individual,
the,
even if
yeah,
it's
individual
a
initiative, because the garden, I think John, maybe later we are talking about this Empire Garden, which is it's kind of very different from the scholar garden, or maybe the individual garden. but the super interesting thing is it becomes kind of, really becomes a cultural space. I think, the first day I showed the score, the hand score, actually, I think this is actually the really space that you perceive the work in the way that it's very much integrated into a kind of living environment. It's not limited with this physical space. Normally it's always not big, the way that how it's, generate these flows of perception actually could reflect the meaning of the nature. It's a constructed nature.
So
it's constructed things, but then it can reach the level that you feel that you are in the nature.
Or as if in nature.
Can I
ask a question as a point of comparison? Because you said something about that it's not by reference to authenticity. And so one of the historical comparisons that I was thinking of is the way in which national parks were started in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of origin stories for national parks, but one of the reasons why they were developed is as a response to increasing urbanization. The idea that there was some kind of vital aspect of the American citizen that was being lost by living in cities. And so these spaces were set up as a way to create an outdoor space that would produce a certain kind of citizen, obviously white, masculine, ableist. But one of the things that has also been noted with regard to aesthetics and the way in which nature is conceived is, you know, these spaces were never wilderness, because wilderness assumes a place that's been untouched by human hands, and no place like that exists anymore. So a lot of work has to be put into a landscape in order to make it look as if it's untouched.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a place where people go to produce a certain kind of self. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there are people who already live on that land who have to be moved out of the way, and lots of ways in which that land is curated to make it seem really natural, even though it's just a way in which people try to imagine what untouched nature might have looked like. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that probably it's very interesting to, for me to think about that, how I think there is always maybe kind of certain the subject is always like included into the so-called object that you try to somehow to think about the whole body, and so therefore it gets more, I think it gets more flexible about, you know, you move around the space whenever, like in the urban or in a wider nature. So therefore that you not try to probably define the meaning of nature by the form and also the kind of representational approach to the nature. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I think, but then this actually becomes a little bit more complicated, to see that how, whether that, through which way that you can reach this state of nature, where that you can somehow enter into the dimension or the connection which is limited in our time. I mean, not mention the there is a very concrete like socio-political agenda that always occupy our life, mm-hmm. And then there is also environmental concern, which could be very much, dominated by a physical environment. So, I mean, to this kind of standardized requirement of a built up the kind of certain criteria.
Right, but I think that's where I get hung up, because what exactly are we talking about when we talk about nature? We're talking about something that we've made up, that we've assigned value to, and that we've given some kind of moral or aesthetic protocol to. Like I said before, there was never any kind of nature that was untouched by human hands, whether we're talking about the wilderness or something highly cultivated or even symmetrical, like a garden. So is there another language that we could use to talk about these places that doesn't hinge on such a freighted word?
Yeah.
You don't have to answer that question.
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. Yeah. I think actually I think there is something, you know, like the you know, between the human like intention and then also there is that we're trying to try to figure out, like for example the meaning of for example, you know, the universe, or you know, the question about what's the what's intention of something beyond the human. And I always think actually, you know, there is this kind of a space that not try to define and fixed this state that you know, let's say that we completely understand, or we rather that it's the space where that you can have a kind of a daily cultivation, where that you can you know, by the accumulation of these practices, and then eventually that we could somehow aware this, you know, probably different moments, while the space actually eventually transform into something that actually is not obsessed, not try to, you know, keep its physical form, because there is things is going to decay, it's going to, you know, there is all this construction actually goes to decay, you know, and then but actually the continuation of the practices, and also the maybe the meaning of why that you know, it connected to our life actually is always continuous. So through the things. So I think for me, like the Chinese garden, one of the kind of type of space that where that you could somehow receive the energy. But again, I think it's not, I think it's just gives kind of certain possibilities, and rather than, you know, to be a kind of sentimental or, you know, obsession, you know, to make it.
Right.
Yeah. So therefore, I think I see probably, yeah, there is, we are in the garden, but I think I cannot say it very, you know, too much loosely about or maybe too much randomly about saying that we are always in garden. No. But I think there is this moment that actually that you perceive a kind of a different individual passes, passes.
Yeah.
And then there are so many like forking paths
yeah,
in the space. And then that generate, for me, is kind of atmosphere where that you see like rock, you know, you see flows of like the different individual traces, and so therefore, and the space really function.
So I think what you just said about decay is interesting, and it reminded me of, well, I can tell a story about it. when I was working on my last book, I did some research in the polar north, in the Arctic Circle, in an island called Svalbard. And one of the things that I saw while I was there is the way in which decay does not operate in the polar north. And what I saw in particular was this. Because there's no liquid water, both living things, or things that are freshly dead, I should say, and buildings, architecture, landscapes, are unable to decay. So in one of the mountains that I visited, there's a cemetery, and in the cemetery are the graves of seven fishermen who died of the 1918 flu. And in their bodies, you could remove samples of their lung tissue, and when they were defrosted, the bacteria were still alive, because they had stayed so cold for so long that there were bacteria there, but also viruses, because they were buried beneath permafrost. But on the same mountain, there were also the remains of coal mines, and it was raw wood, you know, like coal tipples and tramways and things like that. And they dated back to the beginning of the 20th century, and I saw in the same area cabins that were more than 200 years old, and they looked like they had been freshly constructed, because without any liquid water, there's no decay. I mean, there's a little bit of weathering from wind, but not of the kind that you would imagine a building going through over time. Wow. And so I became really interested in this, the relationship between time and temperature, and how temperature is something that can slow the dial, of decay, both in living things and in objects that are made by human hands.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I was thinking about actually, you know, the fragility of the, for example, you know, the material, like, you know, the silk for the Chinese ink painting, or even many of the wood construction in, you know, in the, in many of the culture, actually, that they are not try to build up a permanent things. There is always a concern of the limitation of the material, who somehow there is always this kind of you know, life of the material, but then the way that how it circulate and also it's inherited in a way that through a very different you know, process, which is not rely on or depending on the kind of obsession on the material. And so, for example, there is cases of in Japan that the, you know, once like 15 years that they would rebuild the temple with wooden construction, which is maybe even like even emphasizes on kind of like the temporarity of the building. But then by the constant rebuilding, and then this technique and also the skill of survival actually, you know, it's never lost. So, and I always find that this is actually very beautiful things, because you are actually, I think we have the condition, you know, to rely on the more technique and the material, but then actually that you are very conscious about how to not take this as a kind of ancient technique or something historically is already in the past, because the I think this perception on the time is very different from this the linear way of saying that we are in contemporary time. but rather that you look at the whole kind of stream of the living as a part of the you know, the presence, but then you have to contribute, but also, you know, to continue something, yeah, so I think this is actually the way how maybe to kind of, yeah, to build up the time and also which is even, you know, based on this awareness of that we have a very limited time.